Have you ever struggled to share your faith with others? Join a two-day conference to help you share your testimony, reach loved ones, and live out the Great Commission. Here are the dates. February 24th to 25th, 2017. There will be 10 speakers, all experts in their fields, including science, apologetics, philosophy, pastoral ministry, and evangelism. You'll leave amped with conversation starters, more confidence in your faith, as you anchor your life to concrete truth. Registration now open. Go to ampconference.com. We will see you there.
Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, astronomer Hugh Ross, biochemist Fuzz Rana, astrophysicist Jeff Zwerink, and molecular biologist and Jeanette A.J. Roberts. They will be sharing exciting research from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in roundtable fashion today. Welcome to each of you. We've tossed the dice, had some fun doing that. People spilled over each other, and no major injuries. At least I don't see any bandages, a couple of bruises here and there, but looks like you guys are okay. So we'll get to the discoveries in just a moment. Looks like Fuzz, you're the first.
I will say
to go.
In rare form, Hugh and I went with the probabilities and both rolled sevens. So
you did. So we had to do a runoff, and it turns out Fuzz is going to go first, Jeff second, Hugh third. AJ, you're going to weigh in on the discoveries as we had Jeff do last time. You're going to bounce off the other three. So you're going to serve as kind of a referee and
or an instigator.
Instigator, yes, yes. Just because the discussion, believe it or not, those of you who listened last time, our discussion went a little bit long, shall we say.
You think?
Such a lively time. Yeah. So thanks for hanging in there with us. All right, Fuzz, we're going to go right to it. And you have a couple of papers pertaining to a topic we often like to talk about here at RTP. And that is the subject of pregnancy, right, Fuzz? That's of our favorite subjects.
Yeah, there's quite a few of our staff members who have been pregnant or are pregnant here. And so pregnancy is a way of life here at Reasons to Believe lately.
Yeah, we got a couple on maternity leave right now as we speak.
Yeah, you know, and what I'd like to talk about are some scientific advances that actually indicate that two of the most difficult aspects of pregnancy, namely a phenomena called pregnant brain and morning sickness, actually could be understood as part of God's good design and highlight just how elegantly designed the pregnancy process is. And these insights also have implications for the idea of human exceptionalism and even have pro-life implications as well. Excuse me. But, you know, I've learned over the years as a guy to be really circumspect about offering commentary about pregnancy and the experience
indeed
that women go through during pregnancy. So I'm going to violate my own advice here and again talk about these two advances. And actually, the idea of pregnant brain is really controversial from a scientific perspective. There's not conclusive evidence that women undergo memory loss and kind of have fogginess in their capacity to think during pregnancy. There's just not, again, compelling scientific evidence one way or the other towards that phenomena. But anecdotally, a lot of women describe that experience. And it kind of makes sense because there's a lot of physiological changes taking place in a woman during pregnancy. And so the idea that something like that could happen, you know, isn't unreasonable.
Not to mention just the stress of anticipating another child in the house, perhaps.
Yeah, well, there's a reason why I think that's probably not the basis for something like that. And as I unpack this advance, but actually this advance really doesn't have anything to do with pregnant brain, but it's just a nice way to lead into the discovery. But it does have to do with changes that happen in a woman's brain during pregnancy. And it has to do with actually a loss of gray matter in the woman's brain when she becomes pregnant. And this study was done by a team of researchers from Spain who were motivated to do this study because during adolescence, there's a surge in sex hormones that an adolescent experiences. And this surge in sex hormones triggers a number of changes, one of which is basically a loss of gray matter in the brain. And that loss of gray matter actually is a critical part of the brain maturation process. And it actually establishes what are called neural networks or synaptic connections that establish different neural networks and mature those neural networks within the adolescent brain. And so during pregnancy, women experience huge surges in progesterone and estrogen. And so the thought is, could those same kind of changes be happening in a woman's brain? And so this team of researchers did a study. It's called a prospective study design, where they identified women who wanted to become pregnant for the first time, and they imaged their brains. And then if those women were successful and they became pregnant, when the pregnancy was completed, when it went to full term, they imaged the brain 9 months later, and then 2 years later for women who didn't become pregnant within that time span. They also imaged the brains of women who had never become pregnant as a control, and actually imaged the brains of the fathers as well. And what they discovered is that in women who were pregnant, there was a loss of gray matter, as I mentioned, and that loss of gray matter was highly specific. It happened in very specific regions of the brain, and the consistency of the gray matter loss was so exquisite that they could actually look at the image, the brain image of a woman, and tell whether or not she was pregnant or had been pregnant within a span of 2 years. Interestingly enough, they saw no changes in the brain of women who were not pregnant, nor did they see changes in the brains of the fathers. So this was a change that was happening in the women. Because it wasn't happening in the fathers, the thought was that this is probably due to the sex hormone surges, not to environmental effects like you were alluding to. So
that's a very weak control, I would assert. Because you know, men and women handle stress differently. That's physiologically shown across the board that men clear hormonal responses to stress much more quickly than women do. So,
but you have men and women in the same technically in the same environment, anticipating the pregnancy, going through similar life changes, and so the fact that there's no change happening in the man's brain, but it is happening in the woman's brain, where the big difference is the physiological changes happening in the woman and those changes being driven by sex hormones, suggests that it probably is due to sex hormones. It's not I would agree with your point, it's not a strong conclusion, and it's actually ancillary to the point that I'm trying to make here with the discovery anyway. But it's not due to environmental effects. It's due to physiological changes happening in the women.
So what's going on? Just explain the changes again. So there's a certain amount of gray matter in a woman or a woman's brain before they're pregnant, that during pregnancy the gray matter is reduced significantly in these specific regions.
Right.
Is there anything where that returns later? Is it something?
We'll get to
okay,
that.
Okay, so you haven't addressed
yeah,
it. Yet.
Yeah,
okay,
we'll get to
enough,
that.
So.
Well,
yeah.
One question I had is, what about the control group of the women who had never been pregnant?
No brain change.
Yeah, but where did they draw those women from? Were they relatives or?
I mean, it would be the same. It would be the no, they weren't relatives. It was
okay.
Just the same. And the thing is, it doesn't really matter if they're relatives or not, because they're taking an image of the brain before and an image after for that same woman, and so there are ways you statistically handle that kind of data, but because your baseline is the subject, mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter the relationships. And in fact, they were doing things like looking at mode of conception. Was the conception natural? Was it in vitro fertilization? Saw no differences. So there's a number of controls that they performed in the study. Now, what they noticed is the area of the brain where the gray matter was reduced is an area of the brain that plays a role in social cognition in humans. And in fact, this area of the brain plays a role in something called the theory of mind network. And this network is distinct in human beings. And it's it gives us a property that is unique to humans, at least people think is unique to humans, and that is that we recognize that other human beings have a mind like ours and that we are capable of anticipating what that other mind is thinking and what that other mind might be going through from an emotional standpoint. That theory of mind coupled with symbolism are two properties that anthropologists think make human beings unique, and it lines up with certain concepts of the image of God. And so this is happening in this theory of mind area of the brain. Well, it turns out that they think what's going on here is similar to what happens in adolescence, namely synaptic pruning, which helps to establish networks. So within the theory of mind network, there are these sub-networks that are being established in the brain of a woman who is pregnant, and they anticipate that this was actually part of a process that would allow that woman to establish an intimate bond with her child. So that the mother then has this capacity to be highly sensitive to what that child needs, what that child is experiencing, which is critical, again, for that mother-child attachment. And then to test that idea, they showed women pictures of babies. And this was with the control group as well as with, the mothers that were pregnant. When they showed women pictures of babies, for the control group and for the mothers, nothing happened in that area except when the mother was shown a picture of her child. Really? That area of the brain lit up. Huh. And so what they're thinking is going on here is that this is a process by which you establish, again, the mother establishes this very deep connection. It doesn't happen in the fathers, which is interesting, but it makes sense because if you think throughout most of human history, that mother-infant attachment is really critical in terms of survival of our species because of our large brains. Infants are born with a capacity in such a way that they're helpless, and they're helpless for a number of years. Most of our brain growth and development happens outside the womb over the first 2 years, but it continues to happen all the way into adolescence. And so you have to have that close attachment between mother and child to ensure survivability. For most of human history, the men were out foraging, they were hunting, and that bond between father and child is not as critical for survival as it is between mother and child. So this is really, a very interesting study that I think highlights just the elegant design of the pregnancy process and gives, I think, added perspective on the idea that we are knit together in our mother's womb, that we're fearfully and wonderfully made. But it also, I think, highlights human exceptionalism because it's saying that this theory of mind network in the human brain is a lot more sophisticated than anybody would have actually thought. And again, it highlights human exceptionalism because only human beings seem to have this theory of mind capacity and have one that's that sophisticated that this kind of an attachment can be developed in the midst of our capacity to attach and to connect with a wide range of other people, which allows for complex social networks to be formed. Interestingly enough, and I write about this in Who Was Adam, people don't think Neanderthals had as big of an area of the brain devoted to social networking and social cognition. And the reason why they say that is because the Neanderthal eye orbits were much larger than that of modern humans. And there's this mathematical relationship that people have developed for primates between orbit size and area of the brain devoted to vision and to interpreting, visual images. Presumably, Neanderthals had a much larger area of their brain devoted to vision, which meant that some area of the brain had to be reduced, most likely that area involved in social cognition. And again, this is based on comparative studies of the brains of different primates. And so it looks like even Neanderthals didn't have this capacity for social cognition. So
I have a question. So you were talking about the relation of this particular region lighting up in terms of your theory of mind, right, and human exceptionalism. Is this something that could be replicated, chimps and bonobos and orangutans and crows or, something where animals where there is more highly developed social structures and ones where there's not so well-developed social structures? And is there any way of doing any sort of prediction of what you would expect to find based on what we think of human exceptionalism?
Well, I don't know about studies done with primates, but I do know that there have been studies done in rodents where they look at brain changes during pregnancy for rodents. And what they've discovered is that there are brain changes in rodents, but those brain changes seem to correlate with capacity to forage or efficiency or effectiveness in foraging, and doesn't seem to have anything to do with the connection between between mother and pup in the case of rodents. So I don't know that there have been studies done on primates. This is actually...
I guess I'm not so much asking, whether there has been, but if this is so if we're looking at things where humans are exceptional, and our right. position would be, as I understand it, that there's a social capacity we have that we share with certain kinds of animals and then other animals that don't right. have that social capacity, that one, we would expect to see a difference there. But then I'm also kind of curious, where is this something that would distinguish something related to the image of God in the way we think about things, not just our social capacity?
Well, again, there's a lot of work to be done. This study is really a landmark study. There's nobody that's ever really addressed mm-hmm. this question to the extent that this team has done. So there's clearly going to be additional work done in this area, I would anticipate, right. more than likely by this research group. But, my expectation going into this is that... that we know from that our area of the brain that's involved in social cognition in humans is much larger than it is in other primates. And again, the inference is it's much larger even than it was for Neanderthals. So you could argue, it's not to say that other animals don't have capacity to form social interactions mm-hmm. or have areas of the brain involved in social cognition. It's just that the human area is much larger. And again, it's not clear if other mammals will undergo this kind of change. With rodents, it doesn't seem to be the case.
Right.
So it'd be interesting, again, to see other primates, mm-hmm. what's done here. But at least at this juncture, you could say this really does seem to highlight human exceptionalism or draws attention to human exceptionalism in a way that lines up with the image of God.
No, I agree with that. I think there's a remark. This seems like a remarkable tool to explore some of these issues.
I would agree.
Kind of getting you to speculate on what you think you might find.
Yeah, my prediction would be you wouldn't see it to the same degree or the same extent. I wouldn't say it would be absent, but I would think you wouldn't see it to the same degree or to the same extent in other primates.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's interesting too, from a pro-life standpoint, to shift gears a little bit, is it makes you wonder what effect does an abortion have on a woman who's experienced these surges in sex hormones that are actually altering her brain in such a way to poise her to establish this attachment with a child. And you wonder, what effect does something like an abortion have where that process is disrupted? Clearly, for a woman who's experienced mm-hmm. a miscarriage, I think this also... should suggest to us that there may be psychological issues that result, that beyond the obvious ones, mm-hmm. That we want to be paying more attention to, because it looks like there's an attachment that's interrupted, and this could be really, again, I think, devastating
right.
for women who experience this. So this is, again, something from a pro-life standpoint that I think has implications. But also, I hear a lot of people that are pro-choice saying, look, the fetus, it's just a mass of tissue. It's like a parasite on the woman. Well, it's really hard to argue that when you see the kind of changes that are happening in a woman's brain with the explicit purpose of forming an attachment with that quote-unquote, lump of tissue that's, mm-hmm. A parasite on that woman. The biology doesn't seem to line up with that interpretation of a fetus.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, Fuzz, how about a second?
Real quickly, let's get to the second one. Yeah. This has to do with morning sickness.
Mm.
And again, it highlights the elegant design of, I think, the human pregnancy process. It turns out, believe it or not, that human beings are the only mammals that experience morning sickness. No other mammal experiences that phenomena. And of course, it's involves nausea and vomiting, and as a separate phenomena, disgust towards certain types of foods. And it starts about 5 weeks after conception, peaks somewhere between 2 to 3 months after conception, and then begins to decline and basically cease during the middle part of pregnancy. Well, there are two models for why you see morning sickness in women. One is that it's an evolutionary epiphenomena, meaning that it's not really a true phenomena. It's just a byproduct of an evolutionary history where you have this conflict between the fetus and the mother, which are two genetically distinct entities. And as a result of that conflict in the initial stages, morning sickness is a result. And then the other model that's in play is something called the prophylaxis model, which that morning sickness serves as a protection for the mother and the fetus. And recently there's been
Hold on, before you go on there. So it's claiming that it's an epiphenomena, that it's really just a function of, okay, there's two species or two organisms together. You're kind of like, you put a new liver in, you're going to get rejection type issues. That's the sort of thing they're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And
so, how would they make that argument if humans are the only ones that experience it?
Well, that's part of what's inconsistent with that particular model.
Okay,
that it somehow it seems to be unique to humans.
Okay.
Although you still could argue it's just simply a byproduct of our unique evolutionary history, even if it is unique to humans, and that you don't see it in other animals. In other words, that it's not really functional.
Okay.
And the other view is that it is functional,
right.
And it offers protection. And it turns out that recent work seems to support that idea that there's actually protection going on here. And some of the data that suggests that is that, number one, there's a correlation between morning sickness and reduced miscarriages in women and higher body weights for the infants when they're born. Morning sickness is variable from culture to culture. And so if it was a conflict going on, and this is an epiphenomena due to that conflict, you wouldn't expect to see variability from culture to culture. And again, it seems to be triggered by particular types of foods. And it looks like, bottom line,
Are those two distinct statements, or are the foods culturally related that cause the difference?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so that's what you're arguing.
Yes. Yeah, and so it turns out that you can explain all of this if there is, again, a functional basis for morning sickness and for disgust, if... again, you consider the types of foods that cause that, which are basically strong-tasting vegetables that typically have compounds in them that can be teratogens or reproductive toxins, and meats which would contain pathogens, which would be problematic. And so it looks like morning sickness may actually be a protective mechanism. And the timing of morning sickness is really critical because it's happening during the stage of fetal development where organs are forming. And this is where the effects of teratogens and pathogens are going to be the most devastating to the fetus. Also, this is the time where the fetus hasn't developed its own immune system yet. And this is also the time where the mother's immune system is actually suppressed to allow for placental formation and attachment, because in the sense you've got this organism within an organism and there's a genetic difference. And so the mother's body is going to initially treat that fetus as if it's a foreign object. And so there's got to be immune suppression in order for placental formation in the early stages of pregnancy to take hold. And so this is, again, when you've got the greatest susceptibility to, again, pathogens and things like that. And so the nausea is a way of essentially getting rid of those kinds of foods that could be harmful to the pregnancy. And disgust, which is a separate phenomena, means that women are going to want to even avoid eating those kind of foods. Well, it turns out that there's another benefit to this, and that has to do with the reduced calorie intake. Because when a woman experiences morning sickness and disgust towards foods, there's a reduced caloric intake, which means anabolic metabolic pathways, which are involved in tissue formation, become shut down, which allows for energy reserves to be diverted to the placenta for placental formation. So it looks like this is a really elegant system that protects the mother, protects the fetus at a critical stage in pregnancy, and allows for a placental formation. Now, there are mammals, again, that...
Well, before you go on, is there a corollary or an implication of that, that certain kinds of diets would minimize...
Yes.
So there is a healthy way to eat at that point in time, specifically for what's going to favor and allow the natural processes to work well.
Right. Okay. Exactly right.
And does it include chocolate?
I have no idea. I guess if it doesn't make the woman throw up, it's probably okay. You know, now what's interesting is, this is kind of beginning, this relates this discovery to the idea of human exceptionalism, and that is this idea that human beings are the only mammals that seem to display this particular phenomena. And it's because people think we have such a broad-range diet. We are unique among animals in having a broad-range diet. Other mammals have a much more specialized diet, which means they can consume foods that might be rich in teratogens, but can have an enzymatic machinery that would essentially deactivate or essentially shut down the devastating or harmful effects of the teratogens. Or they can have immune systems that are targeted towards the types of pathogens that they might consume in their diet. But because humans have such a broad-ranging diet, you can't use those kind of enzymatic or immune system mechanisms to essentially buffer against the types of chemicals in organisms that a mother would be exposed to. So the most efficient way of actually offering protection when there's a broad diet that we consume as humans is actually through nausea and through disgust.
Hmm. And now, that seems counterintuitive, and I know you're not a medical Dr. Fuzz, but I would think you would want to increase your caloric intake because you are pregnant. It seems counterintuitive here.
Yeah, but when a woman is increasing her caloric intake, that actually triggers the body to go into an anabolic mode, right? And when that happens, energy resources are actually being diverted away from the placenta because the placenta is going to be treated differently than the woman's, the other tissues in the woman's body. And so by shutting it down, the woman is, or by minimizing caloric intake, energy or resources are not going to be diverted towards tissue production, which allows the placenta to form. Because you have to, I mean, the placenta is part of the woman, but you also have to think it as being a distinct organism as well. So there's that tension between it being part of a woman and again being biologically distinct.
Yeah.
Right.
This goes to the other issue you were getting at earlier, regarding when you're talking about abortion.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, yeah, it's saying that again. But again, you know, this is also saying that there's these protective mechanisms in place that are trying to do everything they can to keep that fetus healthy. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not consistent with the interpretation that this is just a mass of tissue.
Right.
And so even though it's biologically distinct from the mother, there's everything that the mother's body is doing to ensure its survivability.
Yeah.
Now, again, this idea of human exceptionalism, because we have a broad diet, you know, lines up with Scripture, because only human beings are capable of entering into a wide range of environments and exploiting those environments successfully, which means we have to be able to consume a wide range of foods. So this actually connects with the idea of human exceptionalism as well, because it's due to our advanced cognitive ability, our capacity for symbolism, and our theory of mind that allows us to exploit these environments. So anyway, I'll bring it to a close here. I've probably gone way too long here, but...
Well, before you do that, I just find it fascinating that there's a timing in all of this. You know, I mean, in retrospect, it's not surprising, but the idea that there are certain periods of time where this all plays out, you know, naively, I mean, I've seen my wife go through morning sickness enough to know that it lasted for a certain period of time, mm-hmm. and generally, or at least for her, wasn't too serious, but that there's a real, that there's a time stamp on that where that's real critical, or there's a critical phase going on there that can't be recovered from later.
Yeah.
You know, if it doesn't happen properly. So I find that very interesting.
Well, and again, the data seems to indicate that women that don't experience morning sickness are much more likely to miscarry.
Interesting.
Than women who do. So, you know, it's, you know, what we think to be some of the more uncomfortable aspects of pregnancy mm-hmm. actually are part of God's good design. So,
and so increased birth weight was also positively correlated with those who experience morning sickness?
Yes.
Okay, what foods are the issue?
It would be things like strong tasting, smelling vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, things like that.
Brussels sprouts?
Brussels sprouts. And
I'm, I'm not even sure that's a vegetable. Can we just not?
Yeah. In other words, Hugh, keep your foods away from some
from
of our
pregnant women,
pregnant ladies
also,
in the office here.
But
please.
Also meats.
Yeah.
Also meats. You know. So.
Yeah. I've also noticed that driving early in the morning, talking about ringing chickens next, didn't seem to help my wife either. So.
Mm. Wow.
Okay.
All right, fascinating stuff, Fuzz.
Still doesn't help her, even though she's not pregnant.
Yeah, she just doesn't get quite as ill. So,
so you're the expert in that field, huh? you've been around pregnant women a time or two, Fuzz, mm-hmm. and Jeff, you have as well.
Yep.
I've been around a pregnant woman.
Well,
I only know one
particularly.
the sequence very well there. So.
Fuzz is now a grandfather, okay. All right. Thank you for that, Fuzz. Okay, Jeff, you are up next. And we didn't get around to the discovery you had last month, so we're going to talk about it now. Fortunately, we have the cosmological constant being constant. So,
well, as far as we know. So,
as far as we know. Okay.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we've talked a lot about two aspects. One is that when you look at some of the basic descriptions in Scripture of the universe as a whole, kind of the idea that God is stretching out the heavens or the expansion of the universe is one that plays very prominently there. And yeah, that was a remarkable discovery back in the 1920s, ultimately with Edwin Hubble, you know, in 1929, measuring the expansion of the universe. That since that as astronomers and as scientists dug into that, there is a question of what is it that drives the expansion? Is it slowing down? You know, more recently we're talking about it being speeding up. But there are three things that play in the or that drive or determine what the expansion rate of the universe is. So there's one, whatever its initial expansion rate was. You know, so there was some, you know, just after the period of inflation, what it ends with. That's one factor. Two is the amount of mass in the universe, because mass will slow down the expansion rate because it tends to pull things together, and the mass in the universe affects how the space moves. And then about 20 years ago, we discovered that there's also something else causing the universe to expand faster. And we'll call it dark energy, space energy density, or the cosmological constant are some of the monikers it's given. But it was very surprising to find that there was this dark or cosmological constant, because from our physical theories, grand unified theories, and as we look at how our theories work, the amount of this stuff should either be one of two values, zero, which would be relatively straightforward, or it should be the size of the energies where it comes in, which is about 120 orders of magnitude larger than what we found. And so, you know, because of that recognition that it should be 120 order twos, or very easily recognizable. I mean, this would have just expanded the universe so rapidly that we would never see anything. We wouldn't be here to talk about it. So the fact that it wasn't that, most cosmologists said, all right, this has got to be zero. And so that was kind of surprising to find that we actually discovered it, or find that it exists, because what that means is that it must cancel 120 orders of magnitude and leave a very small value. And I point that out just because it's a common or relatively common thing I see is that people will argue that, oh, the dark energy is tuned to one part in 10 to the 120, as though if you were to change it by one part in 10 to the 120, you'd get a universe where life couldn't exist. And that's not really the case. It's just that it's 120 orders of magnitude smaller than what we expected it to be. And so just kind of a caution as to how you phrase that and how you say that, because that's a common criticism of the way that argument is made. But what is interesting is there was a group that was looking at how does the cosmological constant affect the expansion of the universe, particularly related to the conditions necessary for life. And they focused on one condition that is affects life, and that is the prevalence of gamma ray bursts. And so what these are, this is something kind of near and dear to my area of research, is looking at high energy phenomena in the universe, gamma rays and those sorts of things. And what scientists noticed, they discovered back when they were doing atomic monitoring, put satellites up to look for the gamma rays that come out of a nuclear burst, they found roughly once a month, they found these bursts that were coming along. And it turns out that there are things out in the universe that will give off enormous amounts of gamma rays. They're brighter than the entire luminosity of the universe for very brief periods of time. And so now we most think they come out in jets. And you could imagine if you have this jet of material spraying across the galaxy, any systems in there that would have planets like Earth, they're going to get irradiated by this very high energy radiation. It's going to destroy the ozone. The ultraviolet radiation is going to get to the surface. It's going to be very detrimental to life. Mm. And so basically what they were saying is, or the question they asked is, given that gamma ray bursts seem to have a very deleterious effect to planets, what happens if the expansion rate of the universe is different? So if the cosmological constant is greater or smaller, how does it affect the types of galaxies that form, the density of galaxies, and how does that impact the amount of, or the locations where you could have places where life could form? And there's two competing effects here. One is that if things are too clumped close together and the gamma ray bursts are too dense, then you're going to have too many of these extinction level events. It's going to destroy atmospheres and life is going to be exterminated.
You can't dodge the gamma rays.
No, you can't. So, in fact, I made a comment that gamma ray bursts sweeping across a galaxy could basically exterminate have deleterious effect on every planet that's in there that would be exposed to the gamma rays, and that could be basically the whole galaxy. So if things are too clumped, then you have too high a gamma ray burst rate for any given location. But on the other hand, if things expand too rapidly, then you end up with too few stars. Because, if you want stars and planets and stuff to form, things have to clump up. And so you've got these counterbalancing effects, that too slow of an expansion rate will lead to too clumpy of a universe and too many gamma ray bursts. Too fast of an expansion rate will lead to a universe with much fewer stars and much fewer planets. And what they found, at least in their, they simulated universes, numerous universes with different levels of cosmological constants and how this all played out, and found that we really live in the sweet spot where there's ample amounts of stars, but there's not sufficient or not a tremendously large gamma ray burst exposure to planets. And so I just think that's kind of interesting that it supports this, again, just this notion that we live in a universe that seems to be, in some sense, optimized for the conditions for life. Now, I'll make it just a caveat there. It doesn't mean that our universe is designed so that life pops up everywhere, but it does meet this critical set of conditions that allows life to be possible in our universe. And these are the sorts of things that you can't just go somewhere else and maybe things are different. The cosmological constant affects the whole universe, at least everything we can see, in essentially the same fashion. There's you could imagine going to a different star that's smaller or larger, but you can't go to a different universe that has a different cosmological constant. This is kind of one and done type things, and unless you're getting off into a multiverse discussion, which kind of round, or that has a whole different flavor to that discussion. But I just thought it was kind of interesting that even in a very minimal way, that we need to have a cosmological constant, because if there's no cosmological constant, things are going to be too dense. If the cosmological constant is anywhere remotely close to what its value ought to be, there's not going to be any structure in the universe. but we have just enough cosmological constant that the expansion is fast enough so that things are spread out and you don't get too many gamma ray bursts, but it's small enough that you actually get significant clumping, and so you actually get stars, planets, and galaxies forming. Hmm. And so we seem to live in this universe that is designed for the basic parameters of life to be available.
So, Jeff, what paper did this get published in?
It's Physical Review Letters.
Physical Review Letters.
Yes. It's called Cosmic Explosions, Life in the Universe, and the Cosmological Constant.
Fantastic, because I'm going to want to be citing that. But I'm also wondering, are you writing an article on this that we can cite?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. Okay. I might not. So.
Yeah, that might be something I could cite as well.
Let me ask this question. I think actually the idea of the fine-tuning of the universe is an extremely compelling piece of evidence collectively for, you know, not only design in the universe but purpose in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's interesting because I've been reading a little bit about the anthropic principle and preparation for doing a book, hopefully in the future, on the question: is there a biochemical anthropic mm-hmm. principle? And one of the rejoinders that you see from people that are skeptics, and I think this actually traces back even to Brandon Carter, mm-hmm. who was one of the guys who conceived of the idea of the anthropic or these anthropic coincidences, or was a one of the fathers of this particular idea, was this rejoinder. You know, of course, the universe has to have all these parameters that line up to make life possible because we're here.
Mm-hmm.
That if it didn't, there wouldn't be observers to recognize that the universe wasn't just the right way for life to be possible. And Carter, as I understand it, was an atheist. And so this is an atheist interpretation. And I actually find that line of argumentation, I wouldn't say compelling, but very reasonable mm-hmm. on one level for an atheist to respond to this, that, you know, if it was any other way, we wouldn't know it. There wouldn't be anybody here to know it, that mm-hmm. you can only get observers in a universe where you've got that kind of design.
I wonder if the extent of the consistency is something that ought to compel us, in the sense that there's nothing that says it has to be uniform throughout the universe. And yet we find that it is uniform throughout the universe.
And I guess my point here is not so much who's got a better explanation, a theist mm-hmm. or an atheist, but rather that an atheist could actually interpret the anthropic principle in a way that's completely consistent with their worldview and not really be troubled or be moved by the design evidence. And likewise, a theist could look at that and say, wow, this is remarkable mm-hmm. and exactly what I would expect the universe to look like. So,
no, I think your point is well stated, and that's one thing. You know, one of the arguments I have in my head often continually is, okay, I'm looking at this. You know, I could go over and talk to my colleagues at UCLA, and they know most of this. So why are they unpersuaded? And I think it kind of boils down to that. Is that, you know, I ask the question, if I come at this from their worldview, is this something that causes me to change my worldview, or is it something that I can fit within my worldview? And to some extent, you know, the idea that, well, if we're not here, you have to see the conditions that are required for you to be here. There's a bigger question of why are there those conditions? And I think that's an interesting discussion as well, because in the 20, 30 years I've been exploring this, you go back to the 1980s, almost all of the ideas I saw out there were that we're going to explore and find that one equation, that one theory that says everything has to be this way. So there's a recognition that, yeah, if things are much different, you don't get life. But there was the prevailing thought was, we're going to find that theory or that model that says this is the only way it could be. Well, you look at things today, and it's a very different picture. In fact, the picture is, of course, this is the way it looks, is because everything out there happens, and this is the only place we could exist. So it's interesting how that mm-hmm. that the atheist way of looking at that has had to change, you know, and in all honesty, with the multiverse, the Christian way of looking at things has kind of had to change too. So I don't think any one of those is an ultimate decider, but there is a part of me that I look at that and I say, given their worldview, I can see why they look at this and are unpersuaded.
Yeah, well, you know, and the reason I ask that question is because I've been also thinking quite a bit about this in light of, again, how do we engage the theory of evolution, which for me, I think represents a challenge to a theistic perspective. I know that there are Christians who say maybe God employed evolution to create, but I just find that to be biblically and theologically very difficult to accept. You know, and so it seems to me that somebody who embraces the evolutionary paradigm and then uses that as a fuel to drive their atheism can look at the world around us, and even though we don't know how life originates and how the Cambrian explosion happened, we can't explain consciousness, they still can look at nature and say it's completely consistent with what I would expect to see if evolutionary mechanisms, drove the history of life. You know, but I could also, as a theist, look at the data and say I can explain that data from a theistic perspective. And I think sometimes it's enough just to be able to say, look, my worldview is completely compatible with what we see here, that I don't have to do ad hoc maneuvers to accommodate the data. Because oftentimes the argument from an evolutionary perspective is it makes no sense to look at the biological data from a design perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, it's incompatible. So I think, anyway, it's something that I'm just wrestling with, too, in terms of what's the best way for us to engage evolution, because I'm very uncomfortable with people that come to the table and kind of throw the gauntlet down saying evolution is way too improbable, because I think when people are making that statement, whether they realize it or not, they actually are making statements about knowledge about biological systems that they are claiming to have that nobody else who spend their entire lives working in those fields actually have. So
I think one of the subtle things that maybe we don't think about very often is you know, I completely agree with you and Jeff and your assessments that you can argue somewhat coherently and congruently from within a particular worldview. And you know, there's always this idea that the data, our observations, are going to underdetermine the theory, right? So we could approach the same set of observations and come with very different metaphysical positions or worldviews, as whether we're atheists or Christians. But I think that there's a subtle difference there in the way that we fit the data together, right? So how hard do we have to make it? How hard do we have to work in putting our narrative together to make the data fit our coherent narrative or our coherent story? And so so I think, you know, you mentioned that a little bit in sort of how ad hoc do you have to be? You know, how much do you have to imagine that's not actually there in the evidence to make the data fit? And if you become familiar and used to a particular narrative, like the atheistic evolutionary narrative, then you become used to sort of telling the story and interpreting the data in that framework.
Yeah.
But I think one of the other subtle differences that we have to keep in mind is that it's not always whether or not you can build a rational and reasonable explanation, but it's how anemic or how robust are those explanations, right? How appealing are they? How satisfying are they to every aspect of who we are experientially as human beings, right? So to me, that's what I find one of the most sort of repetitive things that goes through my mind as I'm reading more and more, as I'm trying to write the book on Unequivocating Evolution, is I just get entrenched in this evolutionary meta-narrative, and I just think this is not at all satisfying. And you know, it's not that it's not reasonable. It's just, it's not satisfying.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, let me jump in here, because you guys are all way too young.
too young. That's a compliment.
Right.
Okay. Back at the creation of the earth, what happened, Hugh?
Well, before that.
Wow. That's not a compliment.
Well, before the
You're
dinosaurs
fired.
Existed. No, what I want to do is take you back to the early 1960s. I was a teenager then. I heard my first scientific lecture on the anthropic principle. I was actually at the university where the guy who was involved in discovering the cosmic background, Robert Dickey.
Yeah.
He gave a lecture there. He was one of the very first people to talk about the anthropic principle. He was an atheist, but he also laid out some ways to test whether this anthropic principle we're seeing conforms to an atheistic worldview or a theistic worldview. And his comment was that as we continue to explore this, are we going to see a pervasive nature to the anthropic principle? Is it going to be in all disciplines of science? And if we go into astronomy, are we going to see it pervading not just the universe, but our galaxy, our solar system? The other thing he said would be a marker to distinguish the two is whether we consistently see a specific purpose behind the anthropic. And I think that's where we can actually distinguish between an atheistic interpretation of the anthropic principle and a theistic interpretation of the anthropic principle. Do we consistently see a specific purpose? And this is something we've been laying out here at Reasons to Believe, is not only is the purpose making possible the existence of human beings, it's making possible the redemption of a large number of human beings. And that is a consistent marker all the way through, and not only testifies that there's a God that's responsible for all this, it's the God of the Bible that's responsible for all of this.
The thing that's very fishy to me, too, sort of along the same lines, is not just that human beings can exist, but that we can exist with the capacity for discovery.
Right.
Right? And so that, in and of itself, is a very pregnant idea, pregnancy theme.
Well, one thing that Dickey brought out, he says, you know, another thing we can look at is not just human existence, but the fact that we're able to develop such a widespread technology and affluence. So he says that's something that we can bring into the testing.
And see, I think that feeds back into why, not just a theistic, and I actually think the more that I think about this, that our scientific discoveries are not going to be pointing more and more to just a theistic model of creation, but to the Christian theistic model of creation.
Right.
Because all of those things also say that the Creator wants to be known.
Right.
He has set it up so that those creatures who are in his image can actually discover things about creation that point to the Christian theistic creator.
Well, I've also found that scientists who are not believers are impacted by Richard Swinburne's response to the fact that, well, of course the universe looks this way because we wouldn't be able to observe it otherwise. He was the British philosopher that developed the analogy of someone going before a firing squad, and you know, where you got 12 people with rifles assigned to execute this individual, and he survives. Well, his Richard Swinburne's point is that would not happen unless someone had a purpose for that individual surviving. Mm. Just based on the fine-tuning that you see, what's necessary for that individual to survive such an event, somebody must have put blanks in the guns, or they must have purposely aimed a different direction so that he would survive.
But I think that brings up a deeper point, in my opinion, is that I think a lot of what we do are developing tools. You know, there's the anthropic argument, the design, beginning of the universe, all sorts of things that we're doing is there are various tools, and that a lot of the job of an apologist is to understand the other person and figure out how to articulate those arguments in a way that resonates with who you're talking with.
Right.
You know, so Ridge Swinburne's argument is not so much powerful in of itself. It's that it resonated with, oh, that just doesn't seem to make sense. It connects with somebody and gets them to then ask, okay, well, why do I think the way I do? Or it gets them to think deeper about their worldview. And so I think the reason I say that is because for a long time, and I still tend to think, is that if I just get the right arguments out there, then I'm going to be persuasive. I've kind of more shifted to a posture of developing a suite of tools to where now when I'm talking with somebody, I'm interested in what they're talking about, and then say, what do I have where I can bring this into the conversation?
Glad you brought that up, Jeff, because you know, years ago, before Reasons to Believe existed, I was training people in churches how to go door to door and lead people to Christ. And our approach was, you can't go door to door unless you've got a suite of tools. Because every person you talk
Fuller
to...
Fuller brushes.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, go to the Fuller brush analogy. I mean, they came to your door with 100 different brushes because they knew that, you know, you're going to be attracted by one brush and not at all attracted by the other 99. Well, similarly, we as Christian apologists need to take that Fuller brush strategy. Is we need to be going to an individual who we've never met before, we don't know who they are, And step one, before you even give your apologetics, you need to find out where they're coming from. I mean, I tell people that if you're going to be on an airplane talking to a stranger, before you deliver any apologetics, you need to find out what kind of non-Christian you're talking to. Then you can select the appropriate apologetic tool that is most likely to persuade them. And incidentally, you better be prepared with backups, because the one you try might fall flat. And, you know, I've seen people in those situations where they basically give up on the individual. Oh, that didn't work. And so they change the subject or walk away. Oh, no, no.
I think one of the other
turn the air on.
One of the other things that's helpful to keep in mind is that, you know, there are a lot of obstacles that have to be removed somebody comes to faith, right? And you may not be able to remove all the obstacles with the same tool. And some of the obstacles, I think, are probably real obstacles, and I think some of the obstacles might just be defense mechanisms. Yeah. So I think it's important to remember that we do our best to remove obstacles. We do our best not to create obstacles.
That's important, too.
And we always have to trust the work of the Holy Spirit, because all we can do is take obstacles down. We can't actually bring somebody to faith.
Well, let me take you all back to the 1960s again. In the 1960s.
That was a great decade, wasn't it?
It sure was.
Well, it all depends. I had to live through it.
Well, you know, some of us were born in that decade. I can't think of a better one.
Well,
that's why I mentioned it here. Go ahead.
You know, my point is, you go back to the 1960s, 1970s, you had these very large Christian organizations training people for evangelism with only one tool. And what happened is Christians got frustrated and said, this isn't working, and they give up on their ministry of evangelism. So I think, you know, now that we're in the 21st century, we need to realize we need to be giving people a tool chest so that they have multiple tools that they can use. Because I don't want people to give up on the ministry of evangelism.
Well, you know, to me, 1 Peter 3:15 is a very important passage, because it says that we always need to be ready to give the reasons for the hope that we have. And I think a lot of times people approach apologetics and service of evangelism as trying to come up with the reasons why somebody else shouldn't hold the worldview that they hold, as opposed to actually saying, this is why I hold my worldview. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where things like Big Bang cosmology, the anthropic principle, challenges to the origin of life, the design in biology become, I think, very powerful tools. Just simply to say, look, from a scientific standpoint, I hold this idea and it's completely rational. These are the reasons why I hold this idea. Because a lot of times I think non-believers have a perception of Christians and Christianity as being blind faith and, you know, kind of this, you know, idea built on superstition. And when they encounter Christians who have well-thought-out reasons for why they think Christianity is true, it really,
opens doors.
and it creates a disconnect. I can remember a number of years ago I was doing a couple of debates in Vancouver, British Columbia, with a guy named Rob Tarswell. I think you debated him at one point too, Hugh. Really, really good guy, an atheist, I think a professor of psychology or psychiatry at University of British Columbia. Anyway, but after doing two debates with him, during when the session ended, and everybody was kind of just filtering out, this grandmotherly woman came up to me who was an atheist and gave me this big hug, and she goes, you know, I can't believe that you're a Christian because you're such an intelligent guy. But to me, I thought that was a success because, number one, I got a hug out of it, you know, but number two is, because who doesn't want to get a hug from their grandmother? But number two,
or someone else's grandmother.
You know, but number two is it created this major disconnect for her, because it completely changed her perception, I hope, of what Christians are capable of and the reasons that Christians can have. I think those types of things are success when it comes to engaging people. is you're moving that person closer to considering Christianity.
And somehow, even in your intelligence, you managed to communicate that you were huggable, which means you must have had an element of love in what was being conveyed as well.
And I think, where does love come from? There you got another apologetic argument.
I think, another tool. You know, we got to keep that in mind, that we're supposed to be loving the people that we're conversing with, right? Because without love, we're just a clanging cymbal and a noisy gong.
Jeff Lee Smolin quoted in the article here that you used from sciencemag.org, since Hugh, you mentioned the anthropic principle, Lee Smolin, a theoretical physicist at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Canada, has said here that he adds, all truly anthropic arguments to date fall back on fallacies or circular reasoning. Any comment on that from either of you?
Well, this kind of goes to Fuzz's point, is that, or at least part of what Fuzz's point was originally, is that we're here. The fact that we're here demands that we see something that allows us to be here. I think that's part of his point about the circular reasoning.
That's exactly what Lee is referring to, because he's written about this before. And that's actually what motivated Richard Swinburne to develop his philosophical analogy, was exactly people like Lee Smolin.
All right. Okay. Have we tossed that one around enough?
I think so.
Okay. Good stuff.
Sure. I'm looking at the clock, Joe. We've gone an hour.
Yeah, do it, Hugh.
No problem, Hugh.
Because I'm willing to go lead this till next time.
No. We're going to get into
it. We went 90 minutes last time. You still got a half hour.
I'm not going to take half
are you
an hung, hour.
Are you hungry, Hugh? You want some of those meats with Fuzz? What are the chemicals they have in them?
It's a broccoli.
Teratogens. Pathogens.
Teratogens and...
and pathogens.
I was about willing to say that teratogens were made up words. I didn't think that was a word. I like that word, though.
So. It's not a made up word. I mean, all words in some sense are made up words, but
you don't want chocolate, do you? Do you, Hugh?
No, unless it's 100%. So,
okay.
But if you got teratogens, I'll take some.
They're nasty things.
Nonetheless, you have a couple of discoveries to talk about here from the fossil record that seem to highlight what we know from the fossil record that are consistent with RTB's creation model. Is that correct?
Well, it is. I mean, often you hear atheists saying, well, you know, the fossil record's incomplete. Therefore, you can't use the fossil record as an argument against an evolutionary or an atheistic paradigm. I'm impressed that, yes, the fossil record is incomplete, but I'm amazed at how complete it is. I mean...
complete or sufficient?
Well, sufficient in the sense that there really isn't a lot of doubt from the fossil record that we're going to be finding fossils that are going to radically overturn everything we know about the history of life.
Okay, all right.
It's sufficient that I think we've got a trustworthy record of what the history of life on planet Earth is. But yeah, as I read the scientific literature, they keep finding new fossils. And sometimes they find fossils that really have dramatic significance for the philosophy of the origin and history of life. And these are two examples published in the journal Nature, one in the November issue and one in the December issue, that I think fall into that category. And the first one has to do with fossils that were discovered that date really, really far back in time. In fact, the date that they came on was 2.52 billion years ago, which puts it before the Great Oxidation Event. The Great Oxidation Event, that was between about 2.0 and 2.4 billion years ago, and that's when the oxygen level in the atmosphere of the Earth went from less than 0.001% up to maybe 1 or 2%, and then shortly thereafter dropped down to about below 1%. That's what's called the Great Oxidation Event. Doesn't seem dramatic, just going from, you know, 0 up to 1 or 2%. But when you consider it went from less than 0.001% up to more than 1%, that's a factor of 1,000 difference, more than 1,000 times greater oxygen being pumped into the atmosphere. And what this paper addresses is that for a long time, scientists had the idea that life before the Great Oxidation Event had to be really simple and not very diverse at all. And so this paper is saying, well, wait a minute, we've now found fossils of microbes. Number one, these are really big microbes. Your typical bacterium is about a micron across. That's a thousandth of a millimeter across, which means you're probably not going to see it with a naked eye. But these are microbes that they found. The smallest is 20 microns across. The biggest is 265 microns across. Now, at 265 microns, that's more than a quarter of a millimeter. You can easily see that with a naked eye. And this matches some of the largest single-celled organisms we see on the planet today. Matter of fact, they were able to show not only were they exceptionally large, that these were sulfur oxidizing bacteria. And the largest bacteria we see in the face of the earth, likewise, are sulfur oxidizing bacteria. And we know these are complex bacteria able to oxidize sulfur. And so this shows that, hey, we had a much more complex ecosystem before the great oxidation event than we had previously thought. In fact, they're making the point that we now know that virtually all metabolic forms of life that have ever existed existed before the great oxidation event. So instead of having this long, gradual process of evolution and developing new metabolic mechanisms within life on planet Earth, it's like it's all there before the great oxidation event. This fits our model here at Reasons to Believe of one of God aggressively packing the planet with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible, for as long as possible, in order to ensure that we human beings have all the biodeposit resources we need to launch and sustain global high-technology civilization and use that for the completion of the Great Commission.
Is the argument that you need a certain amount of oxygen for a gradual evolutionary formation?
From
the other side.
Yeah, from the other side, you'd be arguing that life would begin with a single species of a rather primitive microbe and would very gradually diversify and become more and more complex, and you'd gradually be finding more and more metabolic pathways operating inside these microbes. This paper is making the point that that doesn't seem to be the way it looks. Rather, we're seeing this huge diversity of microbes with all the different...
By diversity, how many? What kinds are you...
What they're saying is before the great oxidation event, every metabolic pathway we see operating within microbes today was there before the great oxidation event.
That still gives it about 1.5 billion years to have developed, though, doesn't it, you?
It does. But instead of taking all these billions of years, it just all happens in, 2.52 minus 3 points, 1.3
What about the
years.
Earlier, what about the data that supports life signs even earlier than that, pushes it back to 3.8 billion years?
At least at 3.5 billion years, you do have evidence for sulfur oxidation as a metabolic pathway, something called sulfur disproportionation.
Yeah,
yeah. For lay people, Fuzz, the origin of life occurs when?
Well, the...
It's controversial.
3.8 billion 3. Years.
3.8, 4.1.
We definitely have life on the planet at 3.8 billion years ago.
Okay, so this is 2.52, Hugh?
Right.
It is.
So,
but in addition to that, you also have evidence for methanogenesis, methanotrophism, and photosynthesis. So
yeah, that all goes back previous to 3.5 billion because you got isotope signatures, isotope ratio signatures that tell you that there was photosynthetic life back there. You got these two different kinds of methane eating and a methane producing bacteria. You got these sulfate reducing bacteria existing way back then. What this paper is pointing out is we now have these gigantic microbes that are oxidizing sulfur, something that's totally unexpected.
And we actually have fossils of them.
Got
right?
fossils of them,
and
right?
Instead of just like chemical signatures or.
Although
or
we do have, actually have at 3.5 billion years ago, a number of macroscopic fossils, stromatolites, microbial mats. There are also microfossils, and recently we've discovered stromatolites at 3.8 billion year old rock formations in Greenland. And the stromatolites imply a complex microbial ecosystem within the stromatolite. If you use modern day analogs as a way to interpret what you see there. So
stromatolites are geological formations that are residues of mat forming bacteria, right?
Right.
For those people that may not know
what ends up happening is you have photosynthetic bacteria that are secreting basically a film, and then you have mineral deposits forming on the film. The bacteria migrate up through the mineral deposits and lay down another film, and they repeat that over and over again, and it creates these dome-like structures that are shaped by, you know, water currents and things like that. But then within the underneath layers, you have anaerobic bacteria that come in and populate those areas. So the assumption is if you see stromatolites, you've got complex ecosystems. So this is a great discovery that just, it gives you, because there's an element of controversy about all these as biomarkers, this kind of a discovery creates this consistent picture that makes that earlier life or the evidence for earlier life much more compelling.
More reasonable. So,
I just have a question. So, yeah, I mean, again, as someone who hasn't studied this extensively, I mean, outside of a lot of largely discussions I've had around here and interactions with because of my speaking, is that the idea I would have from a naturalist perspective is somehow life got started. But once you get life started, especially in microbial life, that's going to change and diversify and grow pretty quickly because there's just lots of environments and it happens so rapidly. There's lots of it. So wouldn't you, I mean, does this in any way distinguish a theistic scenario from a naturalistic scenario?
Well, I mean, if you,
I think one of the biggest things that gets glossed over, right, or equivocated is the source of novelty, right, and evolutionary novelty. And so if you start with a very diverse bacterial population or microbial population, then you're already starting with an extreme number of diverse genes or DNA elements that could be exchanged through horizontal gene transfer, which microbes do on a daily basis. But that's not the same question as taking abiotic systems or abiotic compounds and putting them into something that we would classify as living, able to self-reproduce in a way that's, you know, homeostatic and can produce itself but can also change. You can't take a living organism and necessarily diversify in a vacuum in the sense that if you don't have other living organisms that are already diverse, then the source of novelty or the ability to swap novel genes isn't going to be there. So you actually have to have a diverse population to start with.
So comparing the horizontal gene transfer, all the things we do that see bacteria adapting very readily and quickly today is not the same thing as it would have been very early on, where you're starting from a relatively simple genetic structure.
From a naturalistic point of view.
From a naturalistic point of view.
Okay. From a creation model, we would expect God to create robust and diverse organisms.
But the thing is, I mean, photosynthesis is one of the most complex metabolic processes, and some of the sulfur metabolism is right behind it in complexity. And so the fact that you're seeing that early is really problematic. In fact, there's some wonderful statements made by Bill Schaff, who at one time was one of the world's leading authorities in the early appearance of life on Earth, who argued that the very first organisms were photosynthetic. And he just expressed amazement that something like that would have emerged that rapidly, that early, that the expectation was photosynthesis would be a much later appearing metabolic lifestyle.
So the fact, in some sense, the fact that we see such remarkably diverse and complex systems early on makes the naturalistic origin of life problem, either the origin of life problem or the origin of life and diversity problem, whichever however you want to term it, makes that even more dramatic.
It does.
Okay.
Well, and it really does push a lot of knowledgeable, intelligent people to embrace the idea of panspermia. because it's so difficult to imagine how that might that level of complexity might have developed so quickly on Earth.
Gotcha. Well, if you look at high school undergraduate textbooks on biology, the origin of life is always referred to as abiotic stuff producing one organism.
Right.
What we're seeing is that's not what the picture looks like. At the very base of the origin of life, we see a complex ecology manifesting many different chemical pathways. And what was surprising here is that we're finding these organisms, these bacteria, that are so very large, keeping in mind that with the conditions before the great oxidation event, there's no way you're going to get anything except single-celled organisms. The environment doesn't permit the existence. And the other thing I didn't mention is that they also discovered that these...
So, hold on. So you're not going to get like multicellular animal type things, but you could get single-cell communal organisms.
You can get single-cell communal organisms.
Quorum-forming bacteria.
You just don't have the chemical environment to support, you know, these...
Yeah, I got that. So, okay.
But they did also discover in these fossils that these very large microbes...
I love it. He's holding out his hands like it's a 12-inch pizza when he says very large.
Well, he loves pizza.
Think of it.
Not many teratogens in pizza.
No, I was just thinking that's a really big microbe. I don't think it qualifies as a microbe anymore if it's that big.
A macrobe.
Well, I'm doing that on purpose, AJ, because we're seeing these bacteria that are, in terms of their volume, are millions of times bigger than normal bacteria.
Yeah.
I mean, they're enormous.
They are. You know, just not quite that big.
The diameter is 250 times bigger than what we consider to be a large bacterium.
Yes.
So these are really enormous creatures, but they're single-celled. But not only are they single-celled, we're actually seeing them being linked together as a colony. So that's part of the fossil evidence.
They have chain formation, right?
They have a chain formation, right?
I think your comment is important because I remember reading about these large single-celled organisms, and my picture was something about that size.
Slightly smaller than a 12-inch
about that size is like a soccer ball, so just so you know.
Well, the idea is you can see these with a naked eye, I think, is quite remarkable.
It is. Yeah. No, I agree.
So,
all right, you have a second...
Well, I'm also volunteering to put that off because I'm seeing...
No.
You want to go for the next one?
Yeah, please.
Okay, all right.
Okay, go ahead.
The next one is much later in the history of the Earth. We're talking about 544 million years ago. And it's the discovery of the most recent Edicarian fossils yet discovered. That's what was announced here. They found them in Nevada, so not too far from here. They dug up this Mount Dunfei formation, and they found these fossils. And the fossils date to right at the time of what's called the Great Unconformity. If you remember your geology class, that was a major factor in most geology textbooks, is this event where there was an enormous and sudden turnover in the chemistry, the oceans of the world, and the atmosphere of the world. And a number of ideas what was going on, but they think it was very large landslides worldwide pouring off the continents and being dumped into the oceans, basically making the oceans very oxygen poor, but completely changing the chemistry of the oceans. And that's what wiped out the Edicarian fossils. What this paper established, they've come up with fossils that literally date right to the timing of the Great Unconformity. And this is an event that happened just before the Cambrian explosion. Cambrian explosion, 543 million years ago. The Great Unconformity, about 544 million years ago. So we're only talking about a million years. And there's an error bar in both of those. But a very tiny time window between the, according to these fossil discoveries, a very tiny time window between the end of the Edicarian animals, the Great Unconformity, and then the Cambrian explosion of radically different kinds of animal life.
So just a comment on that geological time window. So if it's a million years, is that what I'm hearing you say?
Or less.
A million years or less. That's less than the age of the Hawaiian Islands.
Yes.
And it's less than the age of the Galapagos Islands.
Yes.
And so you're talking about a time frame that should limit any kind of naturalistic evolutionary process
yes.
to something even tighter than we've observed in the Galapagos or in the Hawaiian Islands.
Yes, and also what they point out in the paper is that there's been debate in the scientific literature. Was there a mass extinction event that wiped out the Etacarian animals in the oceans? And they're saying, given the timing of the dates for these fossils and the dates that are well established for the Great Unconformity, then yes, this really is a mass extinction event. So we're talking about wiping out a whole ecological system of animals and then having a time window.
The Etacarian animals.
Etacarian animals. Very tiny time window where you got the Great Unconformity, basically making conditions unsuitable for animal life in the oceans. And as soon as that subsides, immediately we got this incredible Cameron explosion of multiple
phyla and incredible diversity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So again, this.
And again, that's a smaller geological time window than any amount of time that could have produced biodiversity.
Well, especially when you're talking large animals.
Yeah.
Because, you know, previous to the Etacarian, what we're talking about is microbes only. Then you get animals up to 2 meters across. They get wiped out, you're back to a microbe world, and then suddenly we got these Cambrian animals. So, yeah, huge challenge to any naturalistic explanation for the history of life.
All right.
So, thank God for fossils.
Yeah, indeed. All right, great stuff, Hugh. The only thought I had on that was this was in the desert, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Always a desert, Joe.
Well, I know, but I was just thinking when you said unconformity and desert, I just thought of a movie that they could do. I thought of Nonconformists. They ought to do a movie on John the Baptist's life, The Great Unconformity.
Well, there you go.
There you go. All right. Okay. See if you can sell that one to our friends in Hollywood, Joe.
He was an nonconformist.
He was a nonconformist.
Right? Yeah, there
for
you
sure.
go.
Yeah.
Yes,
right.
He was.
Okay. Good stuff as always. Thank you each for your participation. Great discoveries, great discussion. And thanks to all of you for hanging in there and listening. We sure appreciate your coming alongside with us. You know how to connect on Facebook and Twitter. On behalf of the team here, Hugh, Fuzz, Jeff, and AJ, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We will see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.